not a part of the usual pocket litter. He pulled out the keyring with the green fob, his special souvenir of a part of Bridgeport his mother knew nothing about, the part that was down there. The corner pocket, billiards, pool, auto games, Kenmore, 82127. He probably should have hidden it already, or gotten rid of it entirely, and suddenly an idea came to him. Nothing could have really cheered Bobby Garfield up that night, but this at least came close. He would give the keyring to Carol Gerber. After cautioning her never to tell his mom where she'd gotten it, he knew that Carol had at least two keys she could put on it, her apartment key and the key to the diary Rihanna had given her for her birthday. Carol was 3 months older than Bobby, but she never lorded it over him on this account. Giving her the keyring would be a little like asking her to go steady. He wouldn't have to get all gushy and embarrass himself by saying so, either. Carol would know. It was part of what made her cool. Bobby laid the keyring on the shelf next to the tooth glass, then went into his bedroom to put on his PJs. When he came out, Ted was sitting on the couch, smoking a cigarette, and looking at him. "Bobby, are you all right?"
"I guess so. I guess I have to be, don't I?"
Ted nodded. "I guess we both have to be."
"Will I ever see you again?"
Bobby asked, pleading in his mind for Ted not to sound like the Lone Ranger, not to start talking any of that corny "we'll meet again" pard stuff, because it wasn't stuff. That word was too kind. Shit was what it was. He didn't think Ted had ever lied to him, and he didn't want him to start now that they were near the end. "I don't know." Ted studied the coal of his cigarette, and when he looked up, Bobby saw that his eyes were swimming with tears. "I don't think so." Those tears undid Bobby. He ran across the room, wanting to hug Ted, needing to hug him. He stopped when Ted lifted his arms and crossed them over the chest of his baggy old man's shirt, his expression a kind of horrified surprise. Bobby stood where he was, his arms still held out to hug. Slowly he lowered them. No hugging, no touching. It was the rule. But the rule was mean. The rule was wrong. "Will you write?" he asked.
"I will send you postcards," Ted replied after a moment's thought. "Not directly to you, though. That might be dangerous for both of us. What shall I do? Any ideas?"
"Send them to Carol," Bobby said. He didn't even stop to think.
"When did you tell her about the low men, Bobby?"
There was no reproach in Ted's voice. Why would there be? He was going, wasn't he? For all the difference it made, the guy who did the story on the shopping cart thief could write it up for the paper. "Crazy old man runs from invading aliens." People would read it to each other over their coffee and breakfast cereal and laugh. What had Ted called it that day? Galumphing small-town humor. Hadn't that been it? But if it was so funny, why did it hurt? Why did it hurt so much? "Today," he said in a small voice, "I saw her in the park and everything just kind of came out."
"That can happen," Ted said gravely. "I know it well. Sometimes the dam just bursts. And perhaps it's for the best. You'll tell her I may want to get in touch with you through her?"
"Yeah."
Ted tapped a finger against his lips, thinking. Then he nodded. "At the top, the cards I send will say, 'Dear C,' instead of 'Dear Carol.' At the bottom, I'll sign, 'A friend.' That way, you'll both know who writes. Okay?"
"Yeah," Bobby said, cool. It wasn't cool. None of this was cool. But it would do. He suddenly lifted his hand, kissed his fingers, and blew across them. Ted, sitting on the couch, smiled, caught the kiss, and put it on his lined cheek.
better go to bed now, Bobby. It's been a big day and it's late. Bobby went to bed. At first, he thought it was the same dream as before. Spider-Man, Cushman, and Dean chasing his mom through the jungle of William Golding's island. Then Bobby realized the trees and vines were part of a wallpaper, and that the path under his mother's flying feet was brown carpet, not a jungle, but a hotel corridor. This was his mind's version of the Warwick Hotel. Mr. Biderman and the other two Nimrods were still chasing her, though. And now, so were the boys from St. Gabe's, Willie and Richie and Harry Doolin. All of them were wearing those streaks of red and white paint on their faces. And all of them were wearing bright yellow doublets, upon which was drawn a brilliant red eye. Other than the doublets, they were naked. Their privates flopped and bobbed in bushy nests of pubic hair. All save Harry Doolin brandished spears. He had his baseball bat. It had been sharpened to a point on both ends. "Kill the bitch!" Cushman yelled. "Drink her blood!" Don Biderman cried and threw his spear at Liz Garfield as she darted around a corner. The spear stuck, quivering, into one of the jungle-painted walls. "Stick it up her dirty cunt!" cried Willie. Willie, who could be nice when he wasn't with his friends. The red eye on his chest stared. Below it, his penis also seemed to stare. "Run, Mom!" Bobby tried to scream, but no words came out. He had no mouth, no body. He was here, and yet he wasn't. He flew beside his mother like her own shadow. He heard her gasping for breath, saw her trembling, terrified mouth and her torn stockings. Her fancy dress was also torn. One of her breasts was scratched and bleeding. One of her eyes was almost closed. She looked as if she'd gone a few rounds with Eddie Albini or Hurricane Haywood, maybe both at the same time. "Gonna split you open!" Richie hollered. "Eat you alive!" agreed Curtis Dean in a top volume. "Drink your blood through your guts!" His mom looked back at them and her feet, she had lost her shoes somewhere, stuttered against each other. "Don't do that, Mom!" Bobby moaned. "For cripe's sake, don't do that!" And as if she'd heard him, Liz faced forward again and tried to run faster. She passed a poster on the wall. "Please help us find our pet pig. Liz is our mascot. Liz is 34 years old. She is a bad-tempered sow, but we love her. We'll do what you want if you say, 'I promise,' or 'There's money in it. Call Housatonic 58337, or bring to the William Penn Grill. Ask for the low men in the yellow coats. Motto, we eat it rare.'" His mom saw the poster, too, and this time when her ankles banged together, she did fall. "Get up, Mom!" Bobby screamed, but she didn't, perhaps couldn't. She crawled along the brown carpet, instead looking over her shoulder as she went, her hair hanging across her cheeks and forehead in sweaty clumps. The back of her dress had been torn away, and Bobby could see her bare bum. Her underpants were gone. Worse, the backs of her thighs were splashed with blood. What had they done to her? Dear God, what had they done to his mother? Don Biderman came around the corner ahead of her. He had found a shortcut and cut her off. The others were right behind him. Now Mr. Biderman's prick was standing straight up the way Bobby sometimes did in the morning before he got out of bed and went to the bathroom. Only Mr. Biderman's prick was huge. It looked like a kraken, a triffid, a monster. And Bobby thought he understood the blood on his mother's legs. He didn't want to, but he thought he did. "Leave her alone!" he tried to scream at Mr. Biderman. "Leave her alone! Haven't you done enough?" The scarlet eye on Mr. Biderman's yellow doublet suddenly opened wider and slithered to one side. Bobby was invisible, his body one world farther down the spinning top from this one. But the red eye saw him. The red eye saw everything. "Kill the pig! Drink her blood!" Mr. Biderman said in a thick, almost unrecognizable voice, and started forward. "Kill the pig! Drink her blood!" Bill Cushman and Curtis Dean chimed in. "Kill the pig! Strew her guts! Eat her flesh!" chanted Willie and Richie, falling in behind the Nimrods. Like those of the men, their pricks had turned into spears. "Eat her, drink her, strew her, screw her," Harry chimed in. "Get up, Mom, run, don't let them." She tried. But even as she struggled from her knees to her feet, Biderman leaped at her. The others followed, closing in, and as their hands began to tear the tatters of her clothes from her body, Bobby thought, "I want to get out of here. I want to go back down the top. To my own world, make it stop and spin it the other way so I can go back down to my own room in my own world." Except it wasn't a top,
and even as the images of the dream began to break up and go dark, Bobby knew it. It wasn't a top, but a tower, a still spindle upon which all of existence moved and spun. Then it was gone, and for a little while there was a merciful nothingness. When he opened his eyes, his bedroom was full of sunshine. Summer sunshine on a Thursday morning in the last June of the Eisenhower presidency. Ugly Thursday. One thing you could say about Ted Brodigan, he knew how to cook. The breakfast he slid in front of Bobby, lightly scrambled eggs, toast, crisp bacon, was a lot better than anything his mother ever made for breakfast. Her specialty was huge, tasteless pancakes, which the two of them drowned in Aunt Jemima's syrup, and as good as anything you could get at the Colony Diner or the Harwich. The only problem was that Bobby didn't feel like eating. He couldn't remember the details of his dream, but he knew it had been a nightmare, and that he must have cried at some point while it was going on. When he woke up, his pillow had been damp. Yet the dream wasn't the only reason he felt flat and depressed this morning. Dreams, after all, weren't real. Ted's going away would be real. And would be forever. "Are you leaving right from the corner pocket?" Bobby asked as Ted sat down across from him with his own plate of eggs and bacon. "You are, aren't you?" "Yes, that will be safest." He began to eat, but slowly and with no apparent enjoyment. So he was feeling bad, too. Bobby was glad. "I'll say to your mother that my brother in Illinois is ill. That's all she needs to know. You gonna take the big gray dog?" Ted smiled briefly. "Probably the train. I'm quite the wealthy man, remember." "Which train?" "It's better if you don't know the details, Bobby. What you don't know, you can't tell. Or be made to tell." Bobby considered this briefly, then asked, "You'll remember the postcards?" Ted picked up a piece of bacon, then put it down again. "Postcards. Plenty of postcards, I promise. Now don't let's talk about it anymore." "What should we talk about then?" Ted thought about it, then smiled. His smile was sweet and open. When he smiled, Bobby could see what he must have looked like when he was 20 and strong. "Books, of course," Ted said. "We'll talk about books." It was going to be a crushingly hot day. That was clear by 9 o'clock. Bobby helped with the dishes, drying and putting away, and then they sat in the living room where Ted's fan did its best to circulate the already tired air, and they talked about books. Or rather, Ted talked about books. And this morning, without the distraction of the Albini-Haywood fight, Bobby listened hungrily. He didn't understand all of what Ted was saying, but he understood enough to realize that books made their own world, and that the Harwich Public Library wasn't it. The library was nothing but the doorway to that world. Ted talked of William Golding and what he called dystopian fantasy, went on to H.G. Wells's The Time Machine, suggesting a link between the Morlocks and the Eloi and Jack and Ralph on Golding's Island. He talked about what he called literature's only excuses, which he said were exploring the questions of innocence and experience, good and evil. Near the end of this impromptu lecture, he mentioned a novel called The Exorcist, which dealt with both these questions in the popular context, and then stopped abruptly. He shook his head as if to clear it. "What's wrong,
Bobby took a sip of his root beer. He still didn't like it much, but it was the only soft drink in the fridge. Besides, it was cold.
What am I thinking? Ted passed a hand over his brow as if he'd suddenly developed a headache. That one hasn't been written yet.
What do you mean?
Nothing. I'm rambling. Why don't you go out for a while? Stretch your legs. I might lie down for a bit. I didn't sleep very well last night.
Okay. Bobby guessed a little fresh air, even if it was hot fresh air, might do him good. And while it was interesting to listen to Ted talk, he had started to feel as if the apartment walls were closing in on him. It was knowing Ted was going, Bobby supposed. Now there was a sad little rhyme for you. Knowing he was going. For a moment, as he went back into his room to get his baseball glove, the keyring from the corner pocket crossed his mind. He was going to give it to Carol so she'd know they were going steady. Then he remembered Harry Doolin, Richie O'Meara, and Willie Shearman. They were out there someplace. Sure they were. And if they caught him by himself, they'd probably beat the crap out of him. For the first time in 2 or 3 days, Bobby found himself wishing for Sully. Sully was a little kid like him, but he was tough. Doolin and his friends might beat him up, but Sully John would make them pay for the privilege. SJ was at camp, though, and that was that. Bobby never considered staying in. He couldn't hide all summer from the likes of Willie Shearman. That would be buggy. But as he went outside, he reminded himself that he had to be careful, had to be on the lookout for them. As long as he saw them coming, there would be no problem. With the St. Gabe's boys on his mind, Bobby left 149 with no further thought of the key fob, his special souvenir of down there. It lay on the bathroom shelf, next to the tooth glass, right where he had left it the night before. Tramped all over Harwich, it seemed, from Broad Street to Commonwealth Park. No St. Gabe's boys on Field C today. The American Legion team was there taking batting practice and shagging flies in the hot sun. From the park to the town square, from the town square to the railway station. As he stood in the little newsstand kiosk beneath the railway overpass looking at paperbacks, Mr. Burton, who ran the place, would let you look for a while as long as you didn't handle what he called the merchandise. The town whistle went off, startling them both.
"Mother of God, what's up with that?"
Mr. Burton asked indignantly. He had spilled packs of gum all over the floor and now stooped to pick them up, his gray change apron hanging down.
"It ain't but 11:15.
"It's early, all right," Bobby agreed, and left the newsstand soon after. Browsing had lost its charms for him. He walked out to River Avenue, stopping at the Tip Top Bakery to buy half a loaf of day-old bread, 2 cents, and to ask Georgie Sullivan how S.J. was.
"He's fine," S.J.'s oldest brother said. "We got a postcard on Tuesday, said he misses the family and wants to come home. We get one Wednesday, says he's learning how to dive. The one this morning, says he's having the time of his life, he wants to stay forever."
He laughed, a big Irish boy of 20 with big Irish arms and shoulders.
"He may want to stay forever, but Ma'd miss him like hell if he stayed up there. You gonna feed the ducks with some of that?"
"Yeah, like always."
"Don't let them nibble your fingers, those damn river ducks. Carry diseases, they—"
In the town square, the municipal building clock began to chime noon, although it was still only 11:45.
"What's going on today?"
Georgie asked.
"First the whistle blows early. Now the damn town clock's off course."
"Maybe it's the heat," Bobby said. He looked at Bobby doubtfully.
"Well, that's a good explanation as any."
Yeah, Bobby thought, going out. And quite a bit safer than some. Bobby went down to River Avenue, munching his bread as he walked. By the time he found a bench near the Housatonic River, most of the half-loaf had disappeared down his own throat. Ducks came waddling eagerly out of the reeds, and Bobby began to scatter the remaining bread for them, amused, as always, by the greedy way they ran for the chunks and the way they threw their heads back to eat them. After a while, he began to grow drowsy. He looked out over the river at the nets of reflected light shimmering on its surface, and grew drowsier still. He had slept the previous night, but his sleep hadn't been restful. Now he dozed off with his hands full of breadcrumbs, The ducks finished with what was on the grass, and then drew closer to him, quacking in low, ruminative tones. The clock in the town square bonged the hour of two at 12:20, causing people downtown to shake their heads and ask each other what the world was coming to. Bobby's doze deepened by degrees, and when a shadow fell over him, he didn't see it or sense it. "Hey, kid." The voice was quiet and intense. Bobby sat up with a gasp and a jerk, his hands opening and spilling out the remaining bread. Those snakes began to crawl around in his belly again. It wasn't Willie Sherman or Richie O'Meara or Harry Doolin. Even coming out of a doze, he knew that. But Bobby almost wished it had been one of them. Even all three, a beating wasn't the worst thing that could happen to you. No, not the worst. Cripes, why did he have to go and fall asleep? Kid! The ducks were stepping on Bobby's feet, squabbling over the unexpected windfall. Their wings were fluttering against his ankles and his shins, but the feeling was far away, far away. He could see the shadow of a man's head on the grass ahead of him. The man was standing behind him. Kid! Slowly and creakily, Bobby turned. The man's coat would be yellow, and somewhere on it would be an eye, a staring red eye. But the man who stood there was wearing a tan summer suit, the jacket pooched out by a little stomach that was starting to grow into a big stomach, and Bobby knew at once it wasn't one of them, after all. There was no itching behind his eyes, no black threads across his field of vision, but the major thing was that this wasn't some creature just pretending to be a person. It was a person. "What?" Bobby asked, his voice low and muzzy. He still couldn't believe he'd gone to sleep like that, blanked out like that. "What do you want?" "I'll give you $2 to let me blow you," the man in the tan suit said. He reached into the pocket of his jacket and brought out his wallet. "We can go behind that tree over there. No one will see us, and you'll like it." "No," Bobby said, getting up. He wasn't completely sure what the man in the tan suit was talking about, but he had a pretty good idea. The ducks scattered backward, but the bread was too tempting to resist, and they returned, pecking and dancing around Bobby's sneakers. "I have to go home now, my mother." The man came closer, still holding out his wallet. It was as if he decided to give the whole thing to Bobby, never mind the 2 lousy dollars. "You don't have to do it to me. I'll just do it to you. Come on, what do you say? I'll make it $3. The man's voice was trembling now, jigging and jagging up and down the scale, at one moment seeming to laugh, at the next almost to weep. "You can go to the movies for a month on $3. "No, really, you'll like it. All my boys like it." He reached out for Bobby, and suddenly Bobby thought of Ted, taking hold of his shoulders. Ted putting his hands behind his neck. Ted pulling him closer until they were almost close enough to kiss. That wasn't like this, and yet it was. Somehow it was. Without thinking about what he was doing, Bobby bent and grabbed one of the ducks. He lifted it in a surprised squawking flurry of beak and wings and paddling feet, had just a glimpse of one black bead of an eye, and then threw it at the man in the tan suit. The man yelled and put his hands up to shield his face, dropping his wallet. Bobby ran. He was passing through the square headed back home when he saw a poster on a telephone pole outside the candy store. He walked over to it and read it with silent horror. He couldn't remember his dream of the night before, but something like this had been in it. He was positive. "Have you seen Brodigan? He is an old mongrel, but we love him. Brodigan has white fur and blue eyes. He is friendly. We'll eat scraps from your hand. We will pay a very large reward. If you have seen Brodigan, call Housatonic 58337 or bring Brodigan to 745 Highgate Avenue, home of the Sagamore family." This isn't a good day, Bobby thought, watching his hand reach out and pull the poster off the telephone pole. Beyond it, hanging from a bulb on the marquee of the Harwich Theater, he saw a dangling blue kite tail. This isn't a good day at all. I never should have gone out of the apartment. In fact, I should have stayed in bed. Housatonic 5, 8,
337, just like on the poster about Phil the Welsh Corgi. Except that there was a Housatonic exchange in Harwich. Bobby'd never heard of it. Some of the numbers were on the Harwich exchange. Others were Commonwealth. But Housatonic? No. Not here. Not in Bridgeport either. He crumpled the poster up and threw it in the Keep Our Town Clean and Green basket on the corner. But on the other side of the street he found another just like it. Farther along he found a third, pasted to a corner mailbox. He tore these down as well. The low men were either closing in or desperate, maybe both. Ted couldn't go out at all today. Bobby would have to tell him that, and he'd have to be ready to run. He'd tell him that, too. Bobby cut through the park, almost running himself in his hurry to get home, and he barely heard the small, gasping cry which came from his left as he passed the baseball fields. Bobby! He stopped and looked toward the grove of trees where Carol had taken him the day before when he started to bawl. And when the gasping cry came again, he realized it was her. Bobby, if it's you, please help me. He turned off the cement path and ducked into the copse of trees. What he saw there made him drop his baseball glove on the ground. It was an Alvin Dark model, that glove, and later it was gone. Someone came along and just kifed it, he supposed, and so what? As that day wore on, his lousy baseball glove was the very least of his concerns. Carol sat beneath the same elm tree where she had comforted him. Her knees were drawn up to her chest. Her face was ashy gray. Black shock circles ringed her eyes, giving her a raccoony look. A thread of blood trickled from one of her nostrils. Her left arm lay across her midriff, pulling her shirt tight against the beginning nubs of what would be breasts in another year or two. She held the elbow of that arm cupped in her right hand. She was wearing shorts and a smock-type blouse with long sleeves, the kind of thing you just slipped on over your head. Later, Bobby would lay much of the blame for what happened on that stupid shirt of hers. She must have worn it to protect against sunburn. It was the only reason he could think of to wear long sleeves on such a murderously hot day. Had she picked it out herself, or had Mrs. Gerber forced her into it? And did it matter? Yes, Bobby would think when there was time to think it mattered. You're damned right it mattered. But for now, the blouse with its long sleeves was peripheral. The only thing he noticed in that first instant was Carol's upper left arm. It seemed to have not one shoulder, but two. Bobby, she said, looking at him with shining, dazed eyes. They hurt me. She was in shock, of course. He was in shock himself by then, running on instinct. He tried to pick her up, and she screamed in pain. Dear God, what a sound. I'll run and get help, he said, lowering her back. You just sit there and try not to move. She was shaking her head, carefully so as not to joggle her arm. Her blue eyes were nearly black with pain and terror. No, Bobby, no, don't leave me here. What if they come back? What if they come back and hurt me worse? Parts of what happened on that long, hot Thursday were lost to him. Lost in the shock wave. But that part always stood clear, Carol looking up at him and saying, what if they come back and hurt me worse? But, Carol, I can walk. If you help me, I can walk. Bobby put a tentative arm around her waist, hoping she wouldn't scream again. That had been bad. Carol got slowly to her feet, using the trunk of the tree to support her back. Her left arm moved a little as she rose. That grotesque double shoulder bulged and flexed. She moaned, but didn't scream, thank God. You better stop, Bobby said. No, I want to get out of here. Help me, oh God, it hurts. Once she was all the way up, it seemed a little better. They made their way out of the grove with the slow, side-by-side solemnity of a couple about to be married. Beyond the shade of the trees, the day seemed even hotter than before and blindingly bright. Bobby looked around and saw no one. Somewhere deeper in the park, a bunch of little kids, probably sparrows or robins from Sterling House, were singing a song, but the area around the baseball fields was utterly deserted. No kids, no mothers wheeling baby carriages, no sign of Officer Raymer, the local cop who would sometimes buy you an ice cream, or a bag of peanuts if he was in a good mood. Everyone was inside, hiding from the heat. Still moving slowly, Bobby with his arm around Carol's waist, they walked along the path which came out on the corner of Commonwealth and Broad. Broad Street Hill was as deserted as the park. The paving shimmered like the air over an incinerator. There wasn't a single pedestrian or moving car in sight. They stepped onto the sidewalk, and Bobby was about to ask if she could make it across the street when Carol said in a high, whispery voice, "Oh, Bobby, I'm fainting." He looked at her in alarm and saw her eyes roll up to glistening whites. She swayed back and forth like a tree which has been cut almost all the way through. Bobby bent, moving without thinking, catching her around the thighs and the back as her knees unlocked. He had been standing to her right and was able to do this without hurting her left arm any more than it already had been hurt. Also, even in her faint, Carol kept her right hand cupped over her left elbow, holding the arm almost steady. Carol Gerber was Bobby's height, perhaps even a little taller, and close to his weight. He should have been incapable of even staggering up Broad Street with her in his arms, but people in shock are capable of amazing bursts of strength. Bobby carried her, and not at a stagger, under that burning June sun, he ran. No one stopped him, no one asked him what was wrong with the little girl, no one offered to help. He could hear cars on Asher Avenue, but this part of the world seemed eerily like Midwich, where everyone had gone to sleep at once. Taking Carol to her mother never crossed his mind. The Gerber apartment was farther up the hill, but that wasn't the reason. Ted was all Bobby could think of. He had to take her to Ted. Ted would know what to do. His preternatural strength began to give out as he climbed the steps to the front porch of his building. He staggered, and Carol's grotesque double shoulder bumped against the railing. She stiffened in his arms and cried out, her half-lidded eyes opening wide. "Almost there," he told her in a panting whisper that didn't sound much like his own voice. "Almost there. I'm sorry I bumped you, but we're almost." The door opened, and Ted came out. He was wearing gray suit pants and a strap-style undershirt. Suspenders hung down to his knees in swinging loops. He looked surprised and concerned, but not frightened. Bobby managed the last porch step and then swayed backward. For one terrible moment, he thought he was going to go crashing down, maybe splitting his skull on the cement walk. Then Ted grabbed him and steadied him. "Give her to me," he said. "Get over on her other side first," Bobby panted. His arms were twanging like guitar strings, and his shoulders seemed to be on fire. "That's the bad side." Ted came around and stood next to Bobby. Carol was looking up at them, her sandy blonde hair hanging down over Bobby's wrist. "They hurt me," she whispered to Ted. "Willie, I asked him to make them stop, but he wouldn't." "Don't talk," Ted said. "You're going to be all right." He took her from Bobby as gently as he could, but they couldn't help joggling her left arm a little. The double shoulder moved under the white smock. Carol moaned, then began to cry. Fresh blood trickled from her right nostril, one brilliant red drop against her skin. Bobby had a momentary flash from his dream of the night before. The eye. The red eye. "Hold the door for me, Bobby." Bobby held it wide. Ted carried Carol through the foyer and into the Garfield apartment. At that same moment, Liz Garfield was descending the iron steps leading from the Harwich stop of the New York, New Haven, and Hartford Railroad to Main Street, where there was a taxi stand. She moved with the slow deliberation of a chronic invalid. A suitcase dangled from each hand. Mr. Burton, proprietor of the newsstand kiosk, happened to be standing in his doorway and having a smoke. He watched Liz reach the bottom of the steps, turn back the veil of her little hat, and gingerly dab at her face with a bit of handkerchief. She winced at each touch. She was wearing makeup a lot, but the makeup didn't help. The makeup only drew attention to what had happened to her. The veil was better, even though it only covered the upper part of her face, and now she lowered it again. She approached the first of three idling taxis, and the driver got out to help her with her bags. Burton wondered who had given her the business. He hoped whoever it had been was currently getting his head massaged by big cops with hard hickories. A person who would do something like that to a woman deserved no better. A person who would do something like that to a woman had no business running around loose. That was Burton's opinion. Bobby thought Ted would put Carol on the couch, but he didn't. There was one straight-backed chair in the living room, and that was where he sat, holding her on his lap. He held her the way the Grant's department store Santa Claus held the little kids who came up to him as he sat on his throne. "Where else are you hurt besides the shoulder?"
"They hit me in the stomach and on my side."
"Which side?"
"The right one."
Ted gently pulled her blouse up on that side. Bobby hissed in air over his lower lip when he saw the bruise which lay diagonally across her ribcage. He recognized the baseball bat shape of it at once. He knew whose bat it had been. Harry Doolin's, the pimply galoot who saw himself as Robin Hood in whatever stunted landscape passed for his imagination. He and Richie O'Meara and Willie Sherman had come up upon her in the park, and Harry had worked her over with his ball bat while Richie and Willie held her, all three of them laughing and calling her the Gerber baby. Maybe it had started as a joke and gotten out of hand. Wasn't that pretty much what had happened in Lord of the Flies? Things had just gotten a little out of hand. Ted touched Carol's waist, his bunchy fingers spread and then slowly slid up her side. He did this with his head cocked, as if he were listening rather than touching. Maybe he was. Carol gasped when he reached the bruise.
"Hurt?" Ted asked. "A little, not as bad as my shoulder. They broke my arm, didn't they?"
"No, I don't think so," Ted replied.
"I heard it pop. So did they. That's when they ran."
"I'm sure you did hear it." "Yes, indeed." Tears were running down her cheeks and her face was still ashy, but Carol seemed calmer now. Ted held her blouse up against her armpit and looked at the bruise. "He knows what that shape is just as well as I do," Bobby thought. "How many were there, Carol?"
"Three," Bobby thought. Three.
"Three boys?"
She nodded.
"Three boys against one little girl? They must have been afraid of you. They must have thought you were a lion. Are you a lion, Carol?"
"I wish I was," Carol said. She tried to smile. "I wish I could have roared and made them go away. They hurt me."
"I know they did.
I know."
His hand slid down her side and cupped the bat bruise on her ribcage. "Breathe in." The bruise swelled against Ted's hand. Bobby could see its purple shape between his nicotine-stained fingers.
"Does that hurt?"
She shook her head.
"Not to breathe?"
"No."
"And not when your ribs go against my hand?"
"No, only sore. What hurts is..." She glanced quickly at the terrible shape of her double shoulder, then away.
"I know. Poor Carol. Poor darling. We'll get to that.
Where else did they hit you? In the stomach, you said?"
"Yes."
Ted pulled her blouse up in front. There was another bruise, but this one didn't look so deep or so angry. He prodded gently with his fingers, first above her belly button and then below it. She said there was no pain like in her shoulder, that her belly was only sore like her ribs were sore.
"They didn't hit you in your back?"
"No."
"In your head or your neck?"
"Uh-uh. Just my side and my stomach, and then they hit me in the shoulder, and there was that pop, and they heard it, and they ran. I used to think Willie Sherman was nice." She gave Ted a woeful look.
"Turn your head for me, Carol."
"Good. Now the other way. It doesn't hurt when you turn it?"
"No."
"And you're sure they never hit your head?"
"No, I mean, yes, I'm sure."
"Lucky girl." Bobby wondered how in the hell Ted could think Carol was lucky. Her left arm didn't look just broken to him, it looked half torn off. He suddenly thought of a roast chicken Sunday dinner and the sound the drumstick made when you pulled it loose. His stomach knotted. For a moment, he thought he was going to vomit up his breakfast in the day-old bread, which had been his only lunch. No, he told himself. Not now. You can't. Ted's got enough problems without adding you to the list.
Bobby?
Ted's voice was clear and sharp. He sounded like a guy with more solutions than problems. And what a relief that was.
Are you all right?
Yeah.
And he thought it was true.
His stomach was starting to settle.
Good. You did well to get her up here. Can you do well a little longer?
Yeah.
I need a pair of scissors. Can you find one?
Bobby went into his mother's bedroom, opened the top drawer of her dresser, and got out her wicker sewing basket. Inside was a medium-sized pair of shears. He hurried back into the living room with them and showed them to Ted. Are these all right?
Fine, he said, taking them. Then to Carol. I'm going to spoil your blouse, Carol. I'm sorry, but I have to look at your shoulder now, and I don't want to hurt you any more than I can help.
It's okay, she said, and again tried to smile. Bobby was a little in awe of her bravery. If his shoulder had looked like that, he probably would have been blatting like a sheep caught in a barbed wire fence.
You can wear one of Bobby's shirts, huh? Can't you, Bobby?
Sure, I don't mind a few cooties.
Funny, Carol said.
Working carefully, Ted cut the smock up the back and then up the front. With that, then, he pulled the two pieces off like the shell of an egg. He was very careful on the left side. But Carol uttered a hoarse scream when Ted's fingers brushed her shoulder. Bobby jumped, and his heart, which had been slowing down, began to race again.
I'm sorry, Ted murmured. Oh, my. Look at this.
Carol's shoulder was ugly. But not as bad as Bobby had feared. Perhaps few things were, once you were looking right at them. The second shoulder was higher than the normal one, and the skin there was stretched so tight that Bobby didn't understand why it didn't just split open. It had gone a peculiar lilac color as well. How bad is it? Carol asked. She was looking in the other direction across the room. Her small face had the pinched, starved look of a UNICEF child. So far as Bobby knew, she never looked at her hurt shoulder after that single quick peek. I'll be in a cast all summer, won't I?
I don't think you're going to be in a cast at all.
Carol looked up into Ted's face wonderingly.
It's not broken, child, only dislocated. Someone hit you on the shoulder.
Harry Doolin.
And hard enough to knock the top of the bone in your upper left arm out of its socket. I can put it back in, I think. Can you stand one or two moments of quite bad pain if you know things may be all right again afterward?
Yes, she said at once. Fix it, Mr. Brodigan, please fix it. Bobby looked at him a little doubtfully. Can you really do that?
Yes, give me your belt.
Huh?
Your belt, give it to me.
Bobby slipped his belt, a fairly new one he'd gotten for Christmas, out of its loops and handed it to Ted, who took it without ever shifting his eyes from Carol's.
What's your last name, honey?
Gerber. They call me the Gerber baby, but I'm not a baby.
I'm sure you're not, and this is where you prove it.
He got up, settled her in the chair, then knelt before her like a guy in some old movie getting ready to propose. He folded Bobby's belt over twice in his big hands, then poked it at her good hand until she let go of her elbow and closed her fingers over the loops.
Good. Now, put it in your mouth.
Put Bobby's belt in my mouth?
Ted's gaze never left her. He began stroking her unhurt arm from the elbow to the wrist.
His fingers trailed down her forearm, stopped, rose, and went back to her elbow, trailed down her forearm again. It's like he's hypnotizing her, Bobby thought, but there was really no like about it. Ted was hypnotizing her. His pupils had begun to do that weird thing again, growing and shrinking, growing and shrinking, growing and shrinking. Their movement and the movement of his fingers were exactly in rhythm. Carol stared into his face, her lips parted. Dad, your eyes.
Yes, yes.
He sounded impatient, not very interested in what his eyes were doing.
Pain rises, Carol. Did you know that?
No.
Her eyes on his fingers on her arm, going down and rising, going down and rising, his pupils like a slow heartbeat.
Bobby could see Carol relaxing in the chair. She was still holding the belt, and when Ted stopped his finger stroking long enough to touch the back of her hand, she lifted it toward her face with no protest.
Oh, yes, he said. Pain rises from its source to the brain. When I put your shoulder back in its socket, there will be a lot of pain. But you'll catch most of it in your mouth as it rises toward your brain. You will bite it with your teeth and hold it against Bobby's belt so that only a little of it can get into your head, which is where things hurt the most. Do you understand me, Carol?
Yes. Her voice had grown distant. She looked very small sitting there in the straight-backed chair wearing only her shorts and her sneakers. The pupils of Ted's eyes, Bobby noticed, had grown steady again.
Put the belt in your mouth. She put it between her lips. Bite when it hurts. When it hurts, catch the pain.
I'll catch it. Ted gave a final stroke of his big forefinger from her elbow to her wrist and looked at Bobby.
Wish me luck, he said. Luck, Bobby replied fervently.
Distant, dreaming. Carol Gerber said, Bobby threw a duck at a man.
Did he?
Ted asked. Very, very gently, he closed his left hand around Carol's left wrist. Bobby thought the man was a low man.
Ted glanced at Bobby.
Not that kind of low man, Bobby said. Just, oh, never mind.
All the same, Ted said, they are very close. The town clock, the town whistle.
I heard, Bobby said grimly.
I'm not going to wait until your mother comes back tonight. I don't dare. I'll spend the day in a movie or a park or somewhere else. If all else fails, there are flop houses in Bridgeport.
Carol, are you ready?
Ready.
When the pain rises, what will you do?
Catch it. Bite it into Bobby's belt.
Good girl. 10 seconds, and you are going to feel a lot better.
Ted drew in a deep breath. Then he reached out with his right hand until it hovered just above the lilac-colored bulge in Carol's shoulder.
Here comes the pain, darling. Be brave.
It wasn't 10 seconds, not even 5. To Bobby, it seemed to happen in an instant. The heel of Ted's right hand pressed directly against that knob rising out of Carol's stretched flesh. At the same time, he pulled sharply on her wrist. Carol's jaws flexed as she clamped down on Bobby's belt. Bobby heard a brief creaking sound like the one his neck sometimes made when it was stiff and he turned his head. And then the bulge in Carol's arm was gone.
Bingo! Ted cried. Looks good! Carol?
She opened her mouth. Bobby's belt fell out of it and onto her lap. Bobby saw a line of tiny points embedded in the leather she had bitten nearly all the way through. It doesn't hurt anymore, she said wonderingly. She ran her right hand up to where the skin was now turning a darker purple, touched the bruise, winced.
That'll be sore for a week or so, Ted warned her, and you mustn't throw or lift with that arm for at least 2 weeks. If you do, it may pop out again.
I'll be careful.
Now Carol could look at her arm.
She kept touching the bruise with light, testing fingers.
How much of the pain did you catch? Ted asked her. And although his face was still grave, Bobby thought he could hear a little smile in his voice.
Most of it, she said. It hardly hurt at all. As soon as these words were out, however, she slumped back in the chair. Her eyes were open but unfocused. Carol had fainted for the second time. Ted told Bobby to wet a cloth and bring it to him. Cold water, he said. Bring it out, but not too much. Bobby ran into the bathroom, got a face cloth from the shelf by the tub, and wet it in cold water. The bottom half of the bathroom window was frosted glass. But if he had looked out the top half, He would have seen his mother's taxi pulling up out front. Bobby didn't look. He was concentrating on his chore. He never thought of the green key fob either, although it was lying on the shelf right in front of his eyes. When Bobby came back into the living room, Ted was sitting in the straight-backed chair with Carol in his lap again. Bobby noticed how tanned her arms had already become compared to the rest of her skin, which was a pure, smooth white, except for where the bruises stood out. She looks like she's wearing nylon stockings on her arms, he thought, a little amused. Her eyes had begun to clear, and they tracked Bobby when he moved toward her, but Carol still didn't look exactly great. Her hair was mussed, her face was all sweaty, and there was that drying trickle of blood between her nostril and the corner of her mouth. Ted took the cloth and began to wipe her cheeks and forehead with it. Bobby knelt by the arm of the chair. Carol sat up a little, raising her face gratefully against the cool and the wet. Ted wiped away the blood under her nose, then put the face cloth aside on the end table. He brushed Carol's sweaty hair off her brow. When some of it flopped back, he moved his hand to brush it away again. Before he could, the door to the porch banged open. Footfalls crossed the foyer. The hand on Carol's damp forehead froze. Bobby's eyes met Ted's, and a single thought flowed between them. Strong telepathy, consisting of a single word, them. No, Carol said, not them. Bobby, it's your... The apartment door opened, and Liz stood there with her key in one hand and her hat, the one with the veil on it, in the other. Behind her and beyond the foyer, the door to all the hot outside world stood open. Side by side on the porch welcome mat were her two suitcases where the cab driver had put them. Bobby, how many times have I told you to lock this damn... She got that far, then stopped. In later years, Bobby would replay that moment again and again, seeing more and more of what his mother had seen when she came back from her disastrous trip to Providence. Her son, kneeling by the chair where the old man she had never liked or really trusted sat with the little girl in his lap. The little girl looked dazed. Her hair was in sweaty clumps. Her blouse had been torn off. It lay in pieces on the floor. And even with her own eyes puffed, mostly shut, Liz would have seen Carol's bruises, one on the shoulder, one on the ribs, one on the stomach. And Carol and Bobby and Ted Brodigan saw her. With that same amazed stop-time clarity, the two black eyes... Liz's right eye was really nothing but a glitter, deep in a puffball of discolored flesh. The lower lip, which was swelled and split in two places and still wearing flecks of dried blood like old, ugly lipstick. The nose, which lay askew and had grown a misbegotten hook, making it almost into a caricature witch hazel nose. Silence. A moment's considering silence on a hot summer afternoon. Somewhere a car backfired. Somewhere a kid shouted, "Come on, you guys." And from behind them on Colony Street came the sound Bobby would identify most strongly with his childhood in general, and that Thursday in particular, Mrs. O'Hara's Bowser barking his way ever deeper into the 20th century. Roof, 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 roof. Jack got her, Bobby thought. Jack Merridew and his Nimrod friends. Jeez, what happened? He asked her, breaking the silence. He didn't want to know. He had to know. He ran to her, starting to cry out of fright, but also out of grief. Her face, her poor face. She didn't look like his mom at all. She looked like some old woman who belonged not on shady Broad Street, but down there where people drank wine out of bottles and paper sacks and had no last names. What did he do? What did that bastard do to you? She paid no attention, seemed not to hear him at all. She laid hold of him, though, laid hold of his shoulders, hard enough for him to feel her fingers sinking into his flesh, hard enough to hurt. She laid hold and then set him aside without a single look. Let her go, you filthy man, she said in a low and rusty voice. Let her go right now.
Mrs. Garfield, please don't misunderstand.
Tad lifted Carol off his lap, careful even now to keep his hand well away from her hurt shoulder, and then stood up himself. He shook out the legs of his pants, a fussy little gesture that was all Ted.
She was hurt, you see. Bobby found her. Bastard!
Liz screamed. To her right was a table with a vase on it. She grabbed the vase and threw it at him. Ted ducked, but too slowly to avoid it completely. The bottom of the vase struck the top of his head, skipped like a stone on a pond, hit the wall, and shattered. Carol screamed. Mom, no, Bobby shouted. He didn't do anything bad. He didn't do anything bad. Liz took no notice. How dare you touch her? Have you been touching my son the same way? You have, haven't you? You don't care what flavor they are, just as long as they're young? Ted took a step toward her. The empty loops of his suspenders swung back and forth beside his legs. Bobby could see blooms of blood in the scant hair on top of his head where the vase had clipped him. Mrs. Garfield, I assure you. Assure this, you dirty bastard! With the vase gone, there was nothing left on the table, and so she picked up the table itself and threw it. It struck Ted in the chest and drove him backward. Would have floored him if not for the straight-backed chair. Ted flopped into it, looking at her with wide, incredulous eyes. His mouth was trembling. "Was he helping you?" Liz asked. Her face was dead white. The bruises on it stood out like birthmarks. "Did you teach my son to help?" "Mom, he didn't hurt her," Bobby shouted. He grabbed her around the waist. "He didn't hurt her. She picked him up like the vase, like the table. And he would think later she had been as strong as he had been, carrying Carol up the hill from the park. She threw him across the room. Bobby struck the wall. His head snapped back and connected with the sunburst clock, knocking it to the floor and stopping it forever. Black dots flocked across his vision, making him think briefly and confusedly, coming closer, and now the posters have his name on them, of the low men. Then he slid to the floor. He tried to stop himself, but his knees wouldn't lock. Liz looked at him, seemingly without much interest, then back at Ted, who sat in the straight-backed chair with the table in his lap and the legs poking at his face. Blood was dripping down one of his cheeks now, and his hair was more red than white. He tried to speak, and what came out instead was a dry and flailing old man's cigarette cough. "Filthy man, filthy, filthy man, for 2 cents I'd pull your pants down and yank that filthy thing right off you." She turned and looked at her huddled son again, and the expression Bobby now saw in the one eye he could really see, the contempt, the accusation, made him cry harder. She didn't say "you too," but he saw it in her eye. Then she turned back to Ted. "No, what? You're going to jail!" She pointed a finger at him, and even through his tears Bobby saw the nail that had been on it when she left, and Mr. Biderman's murk was gone. There was a bloody ragged weal where it had been. Her voice was mushy, seeming to spread out somehow as it crossed her oversized lower lip. "I'm going to call the police now. If you're wise, you'll sit still while I do it. Just keep your mouth shut and sit still." Her voice was rising, rising. Her hands, scratched and swelled at the knuckles as well as broken at the nails, curled into fists which she shook at him. "If you run, I'll chase you, and I'll carve you up with my longest butcher knife. See if I don't. I'll do it right on the street for everyone to see, and I'll start with the part of you that seems to give you boys, so much trouble. So sit still, Bradigan. If you want to live long enough to go to jail, don't you move." The phone was on the table by the couch. She went to it. Ted sat with the table in his lap and blood flowing down his cheek. Bobby huddled next to the fallen clock, the one his mother had gotten with trading stamps. Drifting in the window on the breeze of Ted's fan came Bowser's cry. "Roo! Roo! Roo!"
"You don't know what happened here, Mrs. Garfield. What happened to you was terrible, and you have all my sympathy. But what happened to you is not what happened to Carol."
"Shut up!"
She wasn't listening, didn't even look in his direction.
Carol ran to Liz, reached out for her, then stopped. Her eyes grew large in her pale face, her mouth dropped open. "They pulled your dress off?" It was half a whisper, half a moan.
Liz stopped dialing and turned slowly to look at her.
"Why did they pull your dress off?"
Liz seemed to think about how to answer. She seemed to think hard. "Shut up," she said at last. "Just shut up. Okay?"
Why did they chase you? Who's hitting? Carol's voice had become uneven. Who's hitting?
Shut up!